Global Capital Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Global Capital Podcast. I'm Ralph Sinclair and I'm the frequent issuer's Managing Editor at Global Capital.
And I'm John Hay, Corporate Finance and Sustainability Editor.
As ever, we'll take you through the biggest and best stories from the capital markets, all of which you can read about in more depth at globalcapital.com. And speaking of biggest and best, this has been a record start to the year for bond issuance in euros, with debt issuance in most markets, not just euros, off to a flyer.
So how much is actually going on, Ralph?
Well, as of this morning, when I queried DealLogic, which has a lot of data on the bond market, 191 billion euros of bonds had been priced. Now, this data excludes asset-backed securities and government auctions, but it gives you a sense of what's going on the primary bond market. Now, that 191 billion euros, that's up 9.5% on the same period last year. Although it should be said that each of the last 4 years, including this one, it's been a new record.
So the markets are sort of on a historical trend of getting bigger, aren't they, as well as the sort of cyclical fluctuations that are undoubtedly benefiting it now.
Yes, and of course in euros you'd expect that because it's a newish currency. It's growing as a capital market. The capital markets themselves are growing. In recent years they've been boosted by central bank bond buying, which has poured extra money into the market. And of course, in terms of euros, it's more countries have joined the euro. So you would expect greater usage of it as a currency. And I think one of the things is that people have been on the lookout for this number this year in particular. I don't really remember people bringing this up in 2020, 21 or 22, which were all record years. And I think that's because the market was so disrupted for chunks of last year that the huge amount of issuance we've seen in the first 3 weeks this year has sort of felt a lot more of a leap, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. The market's clearly riding an upswing as basically sentiment towards credit and debt in general has been improving since the autumn. But a major issuer, a corporate issuer, told me this week something interesting, which is, and he's been in the market a long time and has seen it through every kind of cycle. And he just sort of has a general sort of trust that January is a good time to issue. He told me it was the best month to issue because it was when investors were at their most irrational. And, you know, basically they sort of madly buying anything they can get their hands on. Partly because I think if they make a mistake, it doesn't really matter. They can correct it later. Whereas in the second half of the year, he says they, you know, get sort of judicious and careful, you know, not wanting to sort of spoil their figures by the end of the year.
Well, I think there are two other factors in that as well. And I think one of them is the general herd mentality that you get in financial markets, that if everyone is doing the same thing, you're not going to stand out and be the one who gets fired. And of course, you know, if these are institutional investors, they have a mandate to invest that money in stuff. They can't just sit in cash, even if they don't fancy it. So that's probably driven a lot of demand as well. But, you know, we'll be talking about that in more depth with our bank finance editor, Atanas Dinov, and our corporate bond reporter, Mike Turner, later on. And we'll be exploring how such bond market effervescence is affecting issuance in both of those markets. But first, John, you've written a story about a controversy with our old friend, the sustainability bond market. Can you tell us what's going on?
Yeah, well, just to recap, sustainability linked bonds are this product that started in 2019, where a company can issue a bond and then tell the investors that if it fails to hit a certain sustainability target for its business by a certain date, it will pay them a bit of extra interest, usually a 25 basis point step up in the coupon. And these sustainability linked bonds are a great way to show the market that you are sort of really concentrating on your sustainability targets, because you know you're putting money behind them. You're basically saying, if we fail, we'll pay you extra. And that's sort of impressive to the market. And they've caught on with lots of issues, including this company, JBS, which is the world's largest meat producer. It's a Brazilian company with big operation in the US and other countries. So they issued as much as $3 billion of sustainability linked bonds in 2021.
Okay, so what's the beef?
Well, this week, an NGO called Mighty Earth has taken a complaint to the US Securities and Exchange Commission, alleging securities fraud by JBS in connection with these bonds. And they made the complaint with a lot of fanfare, with, you know, there were photographs of them, including an indigenous person from Brazil who's been involved in monitoring JBS's activities. And the complaint is really that the communication from JBS about its sustainability performance is misleading. And that basically it presents itself as much greener and more committed to climate emission reduction than it really is. And the very interesting thing for this market is sustainability linked bonds are sort of quite controversial, because there's always a sort of argument about whether the targets the companies are fixing onto them are ambitious enough. And this is going to be a very interesting test case of that.
Yes, what specifically is the controversy? So JBS will have defined quite closely what the KPIs are for this bond. Mighty Earth is, I guess, in effect saying that these bonds don't tell the full, or the KPIs on these bonds don't really tell the full story. Now, I mean, to be honest, I'm not a emissions expert or a great expert on the meat industry, but I would wonder whether, if you were willing to buy a bond from a company that's so closely linked to methane emissions and deforestation, whether your environmental credentials are really that high in the first place. But I guess that's another issue. But what specifically is Mighty Earth complaining about here?
Well, Mighty Earth, they campaign on issues like rainforest and agriculture and the damage they're doing to the planet. So they've been working on these issues for many years. And they have JBS in their sights as, is the biggest of the major Brazilian beef companies. And really, beef and soya production are sort of really the things driving deforestation in the Amazon, but also other parts of Brazil and Latin America, more than anything else. And there's also threats from mining and oil and things like that. But it's the agriculture that's really the biggest problem. And a lot of it is sort of small farmers, independents, wildcats who just sort of go and clear some land, and then it's very cheap and easy for them to burn down a bit of forest or bulldoze it, put some cows on it, and then you can sell those to bigger farms, and then they can sell them to JBS or Marfrig or another of these companies. And so the supply chain is very opaque and very difficult to control. And but it's very, very dangerous to the environment and the climate. So that's why campaigners focus on it so much. And so if you've been sort of badgering JBS for years to do more to clean up its supply chain and sort of crack down on these bad practices, and above all, not to kind of provide an incentive for further deforestation, which is what's been happening. These sustainability linked bonds are a sort of interesting target for the NGO, and the reason is that they are tied to only a tiny part of JBS's emissions.
So those now, are the scope one and two emissions, aren't they, which are the sort of the emissions that the company generates directly. That's right, isn't it? And I guess the emissions you're talking about are what's known as scope three emissions.
That's right. Basically, scope one is fuel you actually burn. Scope two is electricity you consume. And scope three is everything else. So it's all the emissions embodied in any raw materials or products you buy, and also in the use of your product downstream after it leaves you. So the major emissions for a beef company are obviously the rearing of the cows and the methane they emit when they're growing up, and any emissions caused by deforestation. Now, these are not touched on at all by JBS's bond, which is explicitly just about basically its factory emissions. So there are about 6 million tons of carbon dioxide a year equivalent. But the total emissions of JBS are estimated to be as much as 200-400 million tons.
Right.
And that's as much as, you know, a whole country.
Right. So I guess Mighty Earth's point is that JBS is only really showing people the tip of the iceberg. So what's JBS got to say about this?
Well, they say that they are very serious about the environment, that they are have been trying for years to reduce deforestation. They've introduced a sort of blockchain-based technology system for farmers to log into and record where they get their cattle from, and that they're really trying on it. They also say that the bonds were, it was quite clear, there was no pretense. It was perfectly openly stated that the bonds were just about scopes 1 and 2, which is true, and the NGO doesn't contest that.
They said, didn't they, that you couldn't calculate, or they couldn't calculate their scope 3 emissions at the time of the issuance.
Yeah, well, this is what a lot of companies hide behind, right, or say truthfully, right, whichever it is. But saying we can't calculate our emissions is a very common thing in the financial and business world, as a way of sort of not having to deal with the problem. And the truth is, they can always be estimated. And JBS may be right not to publish its emissions in scope 3. But one thing the NGO discovered was that they had stopped publishing a key piece of data which could have helped to estimate those emissions. And this is the actual number of cows slaughtered. Now, according to Mighty Earth, JBS used to publish this information with quite a detailed regional breakdown up to 2016. And that meant you could use those figures to estimate, according to an official model of the UN, what the carbon emissions had been from those cattle. But JBS stopped publishing the number of cattle slaughtered in 2017. So it's not, they would argue, it's not giving investors the full picture.
Right. Now, speaking of those investors, and I guess, you know, the market in general and people outside of the protagonist and antagonist in this situation. Now, Mighty Earth is obviously looking for a regulatory enforcement because it's gone with its complaint to the Securities and Exchanges Commission in the US, which is the regulator there. What are the consequences of this going to be? What do people in the market say? Will it put investors off of buying these things? Will it put issuers off of issuing the product? And what's the possible outcome, do we think, of the complaint?
Yeah, well, this is very interesting. And what we're trying to find out, I mean, up to now, not many people in the market have actually heard about the case or digested it properly and sort of thought through the implications. It is quite new, but we were able to speak to a few people about it. I think the first thing that's clear is that this case is going to be remembered. It's big, it's high profile, it's been reported all over the place, and scandals like this do get remembered and they do get thought about for years. So I think it will be influential. Now the second thing is it will depend an enormous amount on what the SEC decides to do. If it makes an enforcement action, I think that will be, you know, quite seminal. But if it doesn't, if it decides, oh, there's nothing to see here, you know, the impact will be much less. And I think the key thing is, we're not talking about actual lying, right? The allegation is that by omitting information about its wider sustainability performance, JBS is misleading investors and give it sort of creating a misleadingly green impression. And
greenwashing.
It's a very subtle Yeah, it's green. They're accusing them of greenwashing, but in this subtle way, where it's sort of like this show that they put on for the market, talking about their, you know, ambition to go net zero by 2040, but meanwhile, actually, they're still increasing emissions. So it's really, this will be a very interesting test case of whether regulators are going to crack down on that sort of, communication.
Yeah, it sort of feels like it's a case that's been waiting to happen, I guess, because, you know, this is a market that I think polarizes opinion. On the one hand, the ESG evangelists, that's the wrong way of putting it. People in favor of the product think it's a great way to advance the cause of ESG finance, even if you have to go through these sort of bumpy learning processes at the start. And of course, you know, those on the other side will say, well, this is simply greenwashing. And how could you even invest in the debt of a company like JBS if you were, or an oil company, say, if you're really serious? You know, they want to sort of defund, I guess, these industries entirely.
You're right. It is controversial. And in a way, that's a good thing. You know, these issues are not easy. And it's a very good thing if there's lots of different opinions about each case and if people argue about it. That's exactly what we need. And it's the exact opposite, really, of the sort of impulse in sustainable finance to sort of have rules and kind of standards that sort of define everything. And, you know, then we can just sort of lazily push our money towards something a bit greener. That is not going to help or sort of cure the problems we're facing. What could is actual, minds being focused on what's really happening and what are the genuine effects of actions. And, you know, I think the sustainability linked bond for companies like JBS, there was also a transition bond, which is a different structure for Marfrig a few years ago. They really do put people to the test. You know, is it more important to support a company that's trying to do better, even if it's in a fundamentally pretty terrible industry for the environment, or should you take a hard line and sort of, you know, not touch them until they improve?
I guess what's implied in what Mighty Earth is doing is probably something closer to the former, that if you're going to have these instruments, then you have to hold issuers' feet to the fire and make sure they are doing meaningful things to make, you know, if they are to have the benefit of being able to issue these instruments. And that surely must be the positive outcome where everybody benefits, I guess.
I certainly think that waking investors up can only be a good thing, and I think this lawsuit, well, it's not a lawsuit, but this complaint to the SEC and the publicity around it could help to do that. Unfortunately, there are a lot of very sleepy investors who will just sort of basically buy bonds, you know, without much discrimination, and in fact, of course, a lot of it is sort of explicitly passively managed. So they basically have to buy everything that gets issued. And that means, you know, there's not necessarily all that much investor control and filtering of what comes out. So I think it does take episodes like this of sort of, scandal, if you like, to kind of wake people up sometimes.
If that's the case, if there is that much, thoughtlessness, if we can put it like that, when buying these products, will greater disclosures matter?
I think so, because yes, I think it will. I mean, if the estimates made by these external researchers about JBS are correct, then the emissions of JBS are huge, right? And if you let's say one of the estimates made by these researchers is that their emissions are the same as those of Total Energy, the French oil company, one of the biggest oil companies in the world, right? So if people see that in sort of you know, written down, they will, you know, take a different view of what it means to invest in a company like this. So I think it does. I think disclosure is very important.
Okay, but then to what extent should the SEC be responsible for that, or other regulators? Shouldn't the market sort of regulate itself a bit better? I think you spoke to a banker for your story, didn't you, who had who claims that his firm have sort of pushed back on sort of KPIs from issuers that either weren't meaningful or appropriate. Isn't that a better way to resolve these problems?
Yes, up to a point. I do think self-regulation is a good thing, and I wouldn't want, you know, the regulators to sort of lay down rules for what a sustainability linked bond has to be. You know, I think that is sort of stifling to innovation, and kind of, you know, the regulator will only ever be slow and behind and sort of deaden things. But what where you absolutely need a regulation and government action is the big picture level. You know, companies simply won't disclose information and unless they're made to, the great majority of them. And you know, we've got into this terrible trouble with the climate because, you know, the free market has not solved it. You know, it's everybody's known about climate change for 50 years, but have we done anything about it? Hardly anything. And that's because, you know, people weren't forced to.
Okay, well, John, I'm sure you'll keep us fully abreast of how this complaint develops, and what JBS is made to do or not made to do, and of course how the market responds to the complaint.
Well, we're turning back to the main flow of the capital markets now. We're going to be talking to Atanas Dinov about the financial institution issuance in so far this year, and Mike Turner about corporate bonds.
Good morning, Mike, and good morning, Atanas. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Good morning.
So a classic sign of investors' confidence in bond markets is when they start chasing higher yields rather than, as we saw last year, retreating to more defensive and less risky bonds. Now, that typically manifests itself either by them buying longer dated bonds or by buying bonds with a lower credit rating or from smaller and less well-followed issuers. Now, Atanas, which is it in the bank bond market?
This week, Ralph, we saw smaller and less frequent bank issuers coming to the bond market with riskier deals. So this is exactly what you said. It was actually a combination of factors. These smaller banks issuing subordinated debt, riskier bonds, or even Greek banks that are not even investment grade, and actually they did all quite well.
And Mike, how about the corporate market?
Well, the corporate market has been there's been a few things happening. It's been going much longer than usual. We've seen many more 10-year plus maturities, which is indicative of investors wanting to pick up a bit more yield. And we've also seen a great response for hybrid trades, which is when investment grade companies print subordinated debt, which means it's lower rated than their credit rating. So that also yields higher.
And do those deals also go well?
They go barnstormingly well, yeah. And there's a few major dynamics. In terms of the maturities, what we're seeing for the first time since the Eurozone sovereign crisis, which was sort of 2009, 2010, is pension funds are back into corporate credit. And the nature of pension funds is they like to match their assets and their liabilities. And that means long-term stuff. So pension funds are all eager to buy long maturity corporate debt, which is, you know, it's an absolute boon for corporate issuers because, you know, nothing's better than printing debt that doesn't mature for another 20 years, so you can just forget about it. And it's worked out really well. Long dated deals have all done well. They've all performed well in secondary. And it's expected to bring more of the same.
So why weren't those pension funds buying bonds before? Why have they been away for so long?
Yeah, well, they were buying bonds. They just weren't buying corporate bonds. And it's because of the central banks in Europe, the European Central Bank and its corporate sector purchase program, which basically meant that curves were incredibly flat. So the amount of yield that a corporate issuer would have to pay for a 10-year bond was not that different to what it would have to pay for a 30-year bond. And that's good for the corporate, but it's bad for investors, because why would you bother buying riskier debt if you didn't get the return needed for it? So now that over the summer, the CSPP effectively ended, they stopped new net purchases, though they are rolling over money that matures. But that means that yields have started rising, spreads have started widening. So suddenly these very long dated deals are attractive to pension funds again.
Actually, Mike, while we're on the topic of investor groups that like to buy long-dated debt, insurance companies are another group. Do they buy corporate bonds at all?
They do. They tend to get lumped in with pension funds when it comes to the distribution stats that are made public. Although an interesting point that a syndicate banker said to me is that, so when you get these distribution stats, you get big chunks of hedge fund, asset manager, and then you get a tiny little slither that says other. And for corporate bond, and that's because there's not enough in there to warrant making it granular and naming each type of investor in there.
Its own classification.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so you just lump them all in together. And now what's happening, or what's expected to happen, is pension and insurance funds will get their own little slither in these distribution stats, because there'll be a sizable enough buyer base to warrant singling them out. And that sounds like, you know, it sounds like something that, oh, who cares, it's just like a pie graph on a chart, but it's, you know, this is significant. It's a lot of money, and the nature of pension and insurance funding is that it's very sticky. They tend to buy and hold it, unlike say the sort of polar opposite would be hedge funds, who, you know, play momentums and, you know, like are happy to
trade the paper a lot more.
Yeah, enter and exit markets, you know, to try and take advantage of daily price moves and things like that, which also plays an important role in bonds, particularly in providing liquidity for bonds. But, you know, issuers like to have this bedrock of core holders who will hold it to maturity, preferably, as that provides a sort of solid level for secondary market pricing. And shows sort of a preference for their bonds for the market.
I think actually it's worth saying that insurance companies, the big revival of their demand was last year. I think in sort of the spring last year, when after the Russian invasion of Ukraine with inflation, interest rates started to rise, there was a big burst of them coming in the spring and early summer last year. But I think the pension funds are the new arrivals this year, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right.
And Athanas, the bank bond market, what's driving the sort of sentiment there? What sort of deals have we seen? I know you sort of mentioned briefly Greek banks and subordinated debt, because of course we saw some of that at the end of last year too, didn't we? And also, are there new groups of buyers driving this, or is it just the usual crowd but just buying more of it?
So it's been really interesting, because there was this credit rally, like you mentioned, Ralph, at the end of last year. It naturally slowed down with the coming end of 2022. But then as the year opened, it went on. And what happened was that we had these big frequent bank issuers. So they were occupying the primary market for the first 2 weeks. They were issuing a lot of debt, record-breaking volume. They were driving the volume. And as being frequent issuers, everybody was buying them. So what happened now is, now that a lot of these banks are in blackout or about to start to go into earnings blackout, investors still have money to put to work, and they're actually buying these smaller issuers. So for example, Spain naturally pays a slightly higher spread, Spanish issuers, because of problems, for example, in the Spanish economy. And when you add a subordination, for example, to Ibercaja Strait, they did a 350 million additional tier one bond. Supposedly, you know, this is the riskiest bank capital but there was demand more than 10 times to cover the deal. And this was showing, you know, how strong demand was for these smaller banks, for even for riskier debt. And a day later, we had a Eurobank, a Greek bank, which is not even investment grade rated. It had demand of about 1.5 billion euros for just a 500 million deal, which again shows you that for this kind of trades that offer you higher spread, higher yield, investors were happy to buy because these issuers, these deals were paying more than these than the bigger, more frequent issuers that were issuing in the first 2 weeks of the year.
So what kind of investors are buying the paper, Atanas?
What you've got here is you've got a bit of a pension funds returning, something similar to the corporate market. On the same day, Ibercaja issued their additional tier one bond. Spanish Iberdrola was doing a hybrid in the corporate bond market. But also, for example, for Greek banks, you have these specialist funds that are focused on Greek banks that are buying them because potentially people were talking of an improved economic sentiment in Greece. So if Greece gets a rating upgrade, then the banks should follow at some stage. But another interesting bit is some investors, which were regular bond investors, which were fearing outflows at the end of last year, have now got new funds to deploy, and they are actually putting larger orders into these riskier and higher yielding bonds.
I mean, that's a big feature of January's capital markets generally, isn't it? That investors' cash balances, either through redemptions, coupon flows, or inflows from sort of end investors, go up. So there's more money sort of chasing deals. What's given those end investors particular confidence? I mean, what ultimately do both of you think has driven such a sort of, I don't know, busy market, and I guess bullishness, you would say, in terms of its sentiment towards credit?
Well, I think that the massive inflow of cash in January has just paved over, sort of glossed over all the issues that were there in December. There's still the same problems, and they're still going to carry on.
One of the aspects driving this is that a lot of investors seem to think that although a lot of the macro issues are still there, they haven't been resolved. There is a lot of scope for tightening, especially in bank debt. Banks are well capitalized. And now that the big funders are done, part of the reason that they're driving their orders into these smaller and riskier deals is they think there is a scope for tightening there and outperformance. So after a really bad year in pretty much any asset class last year, they're looking for an outperformance. So if potentially rates go down, as everybody seems to be hoping, or at least that they've peaked, there is a scope for these smaller and riskier deals to outperform, or that is the thinking as of this week.
But the thing that puzzles me is that there's all this bullishness about credit and investors going longer along the curve and buying riskier issuers, completely different from how they behaved only a few months ago. Really, there's no sort of major reason to be more optimistic. In fact, people are saying recession in Europe is quite likely this year, and it's sort of getting pretty close. So if we're about to go into recession, which is sort of like common currency among people in the markets, then surely this bullishness is going to fade, Mike.
Yeah, well, I think if there's one thing that the ECB taught us during its years of bond buying is that if you throw enough money at it, everything will be all right, regardless of what's happening under the water. And that kind of feels like what's happening in January. So as Ralph said, all the investors get this big splurge of money at the start of the year from various things, need to put it to work, can put it to work. So that kind of glosses over all the problems that are coming. The IMF, like you said about recession, the IMF said this week that a third of the world is going to be in recession this year. So that's, it's a major problem that's on the horizon and hasn't gone away.
And alluding to something you said earlier, Mike, you mentioned about how the European Central Bank has stopped net purchases under its corporate sector purchase program. Generally speaking, the ECB is also removing some of that sort of liquidity that it supplied to the bond market this year, isn't it, through the end of the targeted longer term refinancing operations, which is financing that it provided to banks on the cheap. That's all going to have to be refinanced in the bond market. And also through its asset purchase program generally, it's not going to be there to support the bond market in the same way.
It's not. And we've actually seen some effects of what low liquidity can do this week in the hybrid bond market. The ECB never bought hybrid bonds, but the nature of the bond market was that so much money was sloshing around that even if the ECB didn't directly buy these bonds, investors had enough money just sitting around that it liquidity sort of leaked out everywhere. And now that went, hybrid bonds had a terrible year last year, and issuers are coming to the market this year and their secondary pricing, because things are so illiquid, because no one's selling bonds, no one's buying bonds. The secondary prices, which banks and issuers use and investors use to gauge where a new deal should come, where the rest of the market views the risk of this company, don't reflect what's happening to the company or don't reflect what's happening to the wider world. So what that means is, it sounds esoteric, but what it means in practice is that if you're bringing a deal, you've got no idea where you should start it, because all the data points aren't correlated to anything else because of the low level of liquidity. So what we're seeing is deals coming and then these massive jumps during book building in the yield, going in one case going in by 100 basis points, so 1% during book building, which is kind of unheard of. And the reason that's happening is because of this sort of completely opaque liquidity situation, just leaving bankers have to do their best guess, really. And the issue with that is, as we saw at the end of last year, if you put a deal on screens with a price, there's no guarantee it's going to move in. So you need to price it wide enough to catch attention, but at the same time, you also need to be prepared to launch your deal at that price, which, you know, caught a few people out last year. They ended up paying much more than I'm sure they expected, because they expected the spread to come in by, you know, 30 basis points, just like everyone else has had. But sometimes it doesn't happen.
Mm. I guess the benefit of this sort of increased amount of demand for this riskier paper is that more of these deals will happen, and then we'll have more relevant recent pricing points for other issuers to feed off. I guess the one thing that I think is interesting, though, is that last week we wrote about and talked on here about issuers having a fear of missing out and coming to market because they could, because there was so much investor demand. Now, of course, those large cash balances are going to be eventually put to work and will dwindle, and they will be smaller in future months. And then, of course, there's all the big macroeconomic concerns that we've just named. I guess my question is, why are investors so keen to buy what issuers are selling, given they are also facing the same risks and macroeconomic risks as the rest of us?
Well, in the corporate bond market, and I assume it's similar for the bank market, but yes, there's still a lot of macro risks, but relative to how risky it was in November and December, the risk is coming down. So the US CPI print was at 6.5%, which was below where it was expected. Germany and the UK have posted better than expected economic figures for the end of last year. Still abysmal, and inflation is still massive, but it's coming down, which means that rates are likely going to be stabilizing and coming down over the next 2 to 3 years. So that's why if you buy a bond that has quite long duration and you're expecting rates to come down, that will work quite well in your favor in theory. But that's assuming that things don't all go terribly wrong, and then that totally changes.
Something which I found quite interesting was this week, one banker was telling me that the money market investor, money market fund, that has put so much of its money into short-dated floating rate bonds actually told the banker that, you know, they wanted to stop their investments because they've put so much and they needed to save some for investment in the later part of the year, which shows you just how much investors have sped up and accelerated their investments into the earlier part of the year. Maybe touching onto that fear of missing out, of potentially missing out the tightening in bank spreads if rates actually go down.
Mm. The thing I find puzzling is when interest rates have gone up so much, why these corporates want to issue 20, 30-year debt. I mean, you said, yeah, they can issue it and just forget about it for a long time. But on the other hand, they're locking in a higher rate, aren't they?
I suppose they can turn around and say, but still those rates are low on a historical basis. Would that, you know, has anyone advanced that?
Yeah, that, I mean, that's exactly it. It's still, we're still in a environment where rates are moving upwards and yields are moving upwards. So there was a 20-year deal that came for Ireland's electricity supply board that had a three handle on it, had a 3% coupon. 3.75% coupon, which is, you know, much, you know, 2 years ago that would have been 0.375%, but historically for that sort of coupon for 20-year money is still pretty good.
Well, one thing that maybe sums up this rather extraordinary market we've been having in the first 3 weeks of this year is a comment a banker made to me about hybrid capital, and this was after a couple of extremely successful hybrid deals, including the one by Enel, the Italian electricity company. And he said last year when we rang up any issuer and talked to them about hybrids, they said, call for the exorcist.
What are they calling for this year?
Pension funds.
Yeah.
And to see if this remarkable run of bond issuance is more or less sustainable than JBS's beef production, be sure to read Global Capital or subscribe for free to this podcast at any platform of your choosing. Thank you to John, Mike and Atanas for joining me for this show, and to Gerald Hayes, our producer. We'll be back with more from the capital markets next week. So thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.